This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. New Hampshire House Republicans remain divided over who will lead them. While former Speaker Bill O'Brien has accepted his loss of that post, he says he should still head the party's caucus. O'Brien spoke to NHPR political reporter Josh Rogers.
Whatever happens there, Josh, we're going to have a leader of the Republican caucus, and that will be me.
Meanwhile, State Representative Jack Flanagan, the newly appointed majority leader, says he'll continue to prepare for the next legislative session, regardless of actions taken by O'Brien and his supporters.
He can say whatever he wants to say. Right now, I guess I'm the majority leader, and we will, you know, deal with any issues that the leadership deals with.
Also this week, New Hampshire's Attorney General announced an additional 205 chilling indictments against Nathaniel Kibbe, accused of kidnapping a teenage North Conway girl. Here's Assistant Attorney General Jane Young listing just a few of the many charges.
11 indictments charging him with falsifying physical evidence. 8 indictments charging him with witness tampering. 7 indictments charging him with criminal use of an electronic defense weapon. 4 indictments charging him with second-degree assault.
And the state's Department of Health and Human Services this week released a report documenting systemic neglect and abuse at a residential facility for people with disabilities. Attorney Karen Rosenberg with the Disability Rights Center says many questions remain.
What's going to happen next for these people? Is Lakeview going to be able to continue to operate with minimal oversight from the department, or is the department going to really hold their feet to the fire?
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we cover these stories and many more. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Morning, Laura.
Also with us, Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, thanks for taking time out.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Kathleen, I'm going to lean on you first since you are at the State House so much. We've gotten a parliamentary lesson this week. Lots of terms being thrown around, House Speaker, Majority Leader, Leader of the Republican Caucus. Can you just clarify for us, Kathleen, please, what is going on over there?
Yeah, so I guess to start making sure that people understand what these terms mean. So the Speaker of the House, you know, Sean Jasper has said multiple times, I'm not just a Republican speaker, I'm the Speaker of the entire House. So they're the one who stands up at the front of the room. They make sure that things follow procedure. You know, they give committee assignments. Basically, they run the show in the House.
They set the agenda.
And they are... Well, they were. I mean, they do set the agenda, but the majority leader and the minority leader are the people who really, you know, help craft the policy agendas of their caucus. So, you know, Speaker Jasper has said multiple times that he wants the Republican policy to come from the bottom up, and that's really the majority leader who he's appointed, Jack Flanagan, to be the majority leader, who helps, you know, who runs the caucuses. They had one this week. They have an official caucus. They talk about their policy initiatives, so, you know, lowering business regulations or lowering business taxes or promoting school choice. These are all things that came up in their caucuses as policy initiatives. So where the problem is these people who wanted Bill O'Brien to be speaker – they think that he should be the appointed majority leader because they're saying, well, the Democrats, their elected leader, Steve Shurtleff, is the minority leader. So how come our elected leader, Bill O'Brien, can't be our majority leader? So we're getting this fight between a group of people who want to follow Bill O'Brien as the majority leader and the group of people who are planning on following Jack Flanagan as the majority leader. So I think I'm not even sure how this is all going to play out when it comes to policy because, I mean, policy follows the process of going through the committees. The committees work on it. They make a recommendation. It's not necessarily the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader saying you have to pass this or you don't have to pass this. So we could have a situation where regardless of who they think the leader is, they all agree on these policy initiatives and they get 201 votes and pass. Or we could have a situation where they're advocating for different details of the same bills and then Republicans can't get 201 votes to pass legislation. And then what happens? So I think – you know, right now it's kind of some palace intrigue. I think people who are junkies, you know, get really into it. But we still don't know how this is all going to play out when the session starts.
Well, it sounds like you're saying, Kathleen, that even though there's some element of palace intrigue, like you said, you know, who is going to end up taking this caucus leadership post, there's real policy implications here, too.
Yeah, I think that there definitely are. And, you know, you talk to people on both sides of this issue who have said, you know, we do all have the same goals. We're all Republicans, but the devil is in the details. Is there going to be a group of people that have decided that they want to follow Bill O'Brien no matter what, that no legislation that has the blessing of, you know, Representative Flanagan or Sean Jasper is going to be good enough or conservative enough for them? And how big is that group going to be? Because, again, if it gets too big, then Republicans start needing Democrats to pass legislation. So do you end up shooting yourself in the foot because your legislation gets pulled to the left, or do they all come together? It's complicated, and I think the anger and the emotion behind it is still pretty raw at this point. So what's going to happen when we get to the House floor January 7th? I don't know. And I think that there are a lot of Republicans who are saying we need to put this aside and we need to make sure that, you know, we get our policies through good Republican policies and work together, regardless of who the leader is.
Yeah, well, Dean Spiliotis, one thing we know for sure is that you will be following this on nhpoliticalcapital.com. Yes. What do you make of this from a political analyst
standpoint? And I am a political junkie. Anytime I see another article in one of the newspapers, I'm like, oh, good, let me sit down and read this. You know, if you don't like the outcome of a process, one thing you can do is change the rules of the game. And we saw O'Brien supporters try to do that in the Rules Committee the other day. It failed. They wanted to have the caucus appoint the majority leader rather than the speaker. And that would allow them to appoint Bill O'Brien and have this influence over the policy agenda. You know, I mean, we're right here in the sense that there still may be an opportunity for Jasper and Flanagan, the majority leader, to pass legislation in conjunction with Democrats. That may change the content of the legislation in order to get a majority vote. There's a legitimate divide in the Republican caucus. Bill O'Brien held that meeting the other day. About 100 people showed up. There are 239 Republicans in the House. That's almost half the caucus. And then Sean Jasper held a formal caucus meeting, and it had a good turnout as well. So, you know, the big question mark is, are O'Brien supporters going to be successful in trying to change the rules of the game so that they can appoint him majority leader? Will there be some other kind of compromise where O'Brien gets some sort of, you know, policy chair or something like that? Or is there going to be a real impact on the content of the legislation in the sense that Jasper and Flanagan may have to work with Democrats to get that 201 majority?
Okay, and I want to hear from you, Jeff, and you too, Kathleen, too. But I also want to remind our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Lots to talk about at the State House this week on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions and comments about this story and the others that we'll be covering this hour. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Go ahead, Jeff, jump in there.
Yeah, I just want to say, Dean mentioned that, you know, this reflects a split in the caucus, but I really think what's been going, it's been going on for several years now. It's been the Republican Party in particular has really been maybe cut in half or maybe into more pieces than that. And it's what's going on in the House is a reflection of what's going on in the larger party.
National trend.
Not just a national trend, but the state party as well. You notice that one of the outcomes of this was that the executive committee of the state Republican Party voted to censure Sean Jasper for actually getting elected with the help of Democrats, which is not unprecedented in the history of New Hampshire, by the way. But it was, I think, a 13-9 vote. I mean, it wasn't like a unanimous decision or anything like that. So there's a fissure in the party that we've seen in other races and in primary races that we've seen in the outcome of some general elections. And that's something that's really important to look at in the big picture of what's going on here.
Yeah, go ahead, Kathleen.
Yeah, I agree with Jeff completely that this is it is a broader statement kind of on what's going on in the Republican Party. And the censure vote was 17-9.
Oh, sorry. Apologize.
But to Dean's point, he said, you know, maybe will Bill O'Brien get a policy, be chair of a committee or something like that. Sean Jasper's made it very clear that he is not going to put up with disruption. And I do not see a situation where he says to Bill O'Brien, well, you know what? I think, you know, I want to let you be part of this leadership team. I think his mind is made up that he thinks Bill O'Brien is disruptive and he's not going to put up with it. And people can either come with Sean Jasper or they can stay with Bill O'Brien. And
that seems like a pretty firm line in the sand to you.
Yes.
Because there is precedent in the U.S. Congress where if there's a leadership struggle, they'll create some sort of, you know, deputy whip in favor of policy or something like that.
I don't see that happening. I really don't. And I think that even yesterday in the Rules Committee, you know, Representative Al Baldessaro, kept trying to speak on behalf of these rule changes. And the speaker said to him, if you cannot control yourself, I will kick you out of this room. I will not put up with this.
Yeah. I mean, also the other thing I just wanted to say was that you remember how this started was before they had the caucus had their vote, a letter was sent to members of the Republican caucus by Senator Ayotte and a lot of other mainstream, you know, Republicans, you know, the elected officials and others, urging them not to vote for Bill O'Brien.
Yes, they supported Gene Chandler, former Speaker.
Absolutely.
Who's sort of known as a kinder, gentler House Speaker.
And, you know, this is what I'm talking about in the reflection of the fissure in the party. It's really it really is interesting because that was an unprecedented thing completely when they did that. And it's a reflection that Speaker Jasper is concerned about Representative O'Brien's behavior or his tactics. And that is also true at the higher levels of the party as well.
All right. Well, coming up, we will turn to some other stories, including a rehabilitation center for people with disabilities cited for abuse. We'll find out more, especially whether the state was keeping a close enough watch on this. Also, Christmas comes early on the seacoast. Lots and lots of new jobs at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. We'll also hear from you, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. As we wrap up the top state stories of the week, we're going to turn now to Jack Rodolico. He's NHPR's health and science reporter for a story, Jack, on a place called Lakeview. Now, just remind us what this is.
Sure. So this is about Lakeview Neuro Rehabilitation Center in Effingham. And Lakeview is a broader company that has facilities throughout New Hampshire, in Texas, in other parts of the country. And it's a facility that houses and cares for people with very severe developmental and mental disabilities. A few months ago, the Disability Rights Center put out a couple of really scathing white papers alleging some very, very serious neglect leading to abuse at Lakeview. The most serious case was a situation with a young man that they anonymously named J.D. He was 22 years old. He had a seizure disorder, but otherwise in fairly good health. And 72 days after he was admitted, he was dead. He lost almost 50 pounds over the course of 2.5 months. And the allegations was that there were many, many, many warning signs that this young man his health was deteriorating and that no one really did anything about it. In fact, the morning that he passed away, allegedly there were two staff members that came in. They saw him. They saw that he was non-responsive. And they didn't report it until someone came back later and he was naked on the floor and deceased, probably already deceased.
What a terrible story. So the Disability Rights Center got got involved, and then what?
And then – so basically they put these reports out. The governor ordered HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, to do its own investigation. And so the first part of a three-part investigation came out this week. And what HHS did was essentially sort of confirm – not necessarily a lot of the specific allegations, because there were a lot of other very specific allegations. But what they said was that this place is so chronically understaffed, underpaid, undertrained that it is leading to a situation where patients are being seriously you're creating a situation where terrible things can happen. And there's a lot of evidence that things have. The other side of this, though, is that the state seems to have had a lot of warning signs over the years that there was a problem and hasn't necessarily done anything about it until this big report came out.
So, yeah, who's responsible in these cases, Jack, for oversight and funding? Why don't you take the oversight piece first?
Sure. So on the oversight, within the Department of Health and Human Services is huge, and there is a licensing bureau within that agency, within that department. And essentially, you know, this department is licensing something like 1,000 facilities around the state throughout the year. And they try to do one visit to each facility per year. They are pre-announced visits, so people
know when they're coming.
And it's I talked with a lot of experts this week, and they're pretty incredulous that you could find the types of systemic neglect and abuse that seems to be happening at Lakeview Neurorehabilitation Center by walking in the door pre-announced once a week. I talked to one expert who said it's like trying to figure out how clean my house is by coming over for dinner. I'm going to clean my house up before you come over. So it's really, you know, it's a pretty disturbing story.
And one visit a year doesn't sound like very much.
I mean, they have the authority. Well, I don't know actually, but I should be cautious here because I don't know all of the rules. But yeah, they come in to sort of re-up the licensing. You know, there's other agencies that license them too. In the middle of this investigation, there's a federal oversight committee that apparently re-up their certification as well. So you have to wonder what's going on in these reviews.
So where does this go from here, Jack?
There will be other reports. The Department of Health and Human Services is hiring an external consultant to review what they could have done, to review their responses over the years. So that's going to happen. But Lakeview has about a week now to come up with some kind of response, or the state could go as far as to shut them down or to put some sort of sanctions on them. Right now, they're not allowing new people to be admitted there. So it's sort of a do-or-die moment for this facility, and we don't know what will happen with it yet.
Wow. Jack, thank you for updating on this tough situation.
Sure.
Thanks. As Jack Rodolico, NHPR's health and science reporter, Kathleen Ronan, can you put this in the bigger context for us in terms of New Hampshire and the budget and how we spend money and so forth?
Yeah, so the Department of Health and Human Services is the state's largest agency. It takes up a large portion of the budget. And I think, you know, as we enter the next budgeting process, they've been kind of constantly talking about how over the years they've been losing staff. I mean, every state agency is losing staff. I don't know the exact number, but it's in the hundreds. And I'm not saying the answer is more money or more staff necessarily. I don't know what the answer is. But I think that we've kind of repeatedly seen this question, and the state is grappling with how we care for and treat our most vulnerable populations, whether it's not having adequate community mental health programs that we end up, you know, governing by litigation. You know, somebody sues us and we have to figure out how to address that. And I think that this is another, you know, this is raises another question beyond Lakeview of, are we adequately caring for people with disabilities? And if not, why not? What's the root cause of this here? And I think, you know, that's a question that the Department of Health and Human Services is grappling with and that the state's grappling with as we think about, you know, what our priorities are in the next budget. And again, I don't know what the answer is, but you will probably hear that this department has less and less staff than they have. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, that's maybe one of the reasons that there can't be as many visits or it's tough to pay as much attention to all of these different facilities that are taking care of these populations.
Well, and it's a subject that will likely come up as the budget season kicks off in earnest next year and as agency heads make their cases before the legislature. I want to turn to another story, a happier story, and Jeff Feingold, I'll turn to you first. Christmas came early for the Seacoast, didn't it? 700 new jobs at the Ports of Naval Shipyard. That's a ton.
That's a lot of jobs, and those are really, as they say, very good jobs. They're very well-paying jobs. They're, you know, it's a really great thing for the Seacoast especially and the state in general. But the interesting thing is that it's a result of the agreement they reached last week on the budget, the federal budget through the fiscal year, because there's been a backlog on maintenance work at the shipyard because of sequestration. Do you remember that great word we used to
hard
use
to forget.
All the time?
Yes, we did multiple shows.
So they have all this backlog of work that they need to do. So they need 700 more people, 700 more workers to complete the work, and the shipyard, we do a. Every year, the New Hampshire Business Review for 35 years has done a list of the biggest manufacturing employers in the state. And we never put the shipyard on it because they're technically in Kittery, Maine. But we're talking about thousands of people working over there. And this is going to increase their payroll from like 4,500 people to 5,200. And that's going to bring in well over $500 million in payroll, which is going to have a huge economic effect on the seacoast, you know, New Hampshire, Maine. And the immediate, you know, Massachusetts area, but also just the state as well, because it's really a great thing for that area of the state.
Yeah, good to hear some good news. So from the shipyard to the State House to other stories, we're following up on all of it on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And we want to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Your thoughts on some of the news items that we're covering this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is an economic gift, Dean Spiliotis, to the Seacoast, but also a political gift for the state's congressional delegation, isn't it?
Absolutely. As Jeff mentioned, a lot of this was delayed because of the budget sequestration that we went through. Yeah, we are – New Hampshire benefits from having both Kelly Ayotte and Gene Shaheen, our senators, serving on the committees that deal with bases and these sorts of issues. So it's become kind of a big part of running for any congressional office in the state. You have to be really strong on protecting Portsmouth and our other kind of base interests, naval base and other military installations in the state. So it certainly helps. It's an added layer of protection, but certainly this is really good news for the Seacoast.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. There was some good news this week, folks, although it was kind of a mixed bag. And Dean, I'll turn to you first. The annual homeless count in New Hampshire found the population overall is down.
That is right. The overall population has declined about 3%. This is a study put out by the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness. The only glimmer of bad news in there is that the among veterans and these kind of chronic cases, that is up. So overall, we're down, but particularly among veterans, it is increased. We've been on a steady, you know, decrease since about 2011. There's been resources are limited, but there have been more resources and organizations getting involved in dealing with homelessness. Right now, I think the current total in this study, it says 2014, there are about 1,635 homeless, and 11% of those are vets. So some overall good news, but clearly some concern in there for veterans and these kind of chronic cases of homelessness.
Yeah, Kathleen, and then Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, of course, it's great to see the overall number go down. That's what we want to see as people start talking about this issue and focusing on it more. But I do think that the fact that the number of chronically homeless people is increasing is an issue that the state should be really concerned about. And even, I think people might see those numbers and think, 1,600 people, maybe that's not that many. But if you think about it from a community perspective, the Concord Monitor did a really great series this week on homelessness in Concord. It was a 5-part series. They had a community forum last night that I went to, and about 80 people showed up.
Wow.
And the mayor showed up to talk about this issue. And, when you read those stories and you learned about these people that are chronically homeless, and we learned about the complexities of the issue and how you find housing, and do people need to clean up their substance issues before they get housing, or do they need to get housing to clean up their substance abuse issues? This is such a complex problem, and I just hope that in seeing a report that the numbers are going down, that makes people think that we must be doing it all right, because I don't think we have found a completely effective solution at this point. And we also see, you know, that series brought up the issue that because Concord does have fairly good services for people who are homeless, does that make more people in that similar situation come to the area? Does that exacerbate the problem? So it's it is a really serious issue. And I think it's one that, you know, people need to look at from a community perspective, as well as, you know, not just statewide, but how is this affecting our communities?
Yeah, and you're right. Certain communities are more affected than others. Go ahead, Jeff.
I want to put a damper on this, but I really think that this report is more depressing is not the right word, but it should raise more concerns than it is, because the overall drop in the homeless population, I think, really is a reflection of the economy getting better. People who found themselves homeless now are able to get jobs and actually maybe find a place to live. It's the chronic homelessness on the veterans. And I think it relates to that story we talked about, the neuro rehabilitation center. The state doesn't have the resources to really address these problems. When it's 11% of the homeless people are veterans, that really says there's a lot. There's a problem with the programs we have available for them. And with the chronic homelessness, a lot of this has to do with people who are mentally ill. And, you know, what kind of services is the state providing for those people? That's really – it's a bigger picture than just saying, oh, well, we have fewer homeless people.
Well, and if we're talking about veterans, that's almost really a federal issue, Jeff,
yes.
Right? I mean, they're supposed to be helping veterans upon return from combat
or whatever.
The
services just aren't there. And, you know, when you think it's for veterans, you think, you know, this would be the top priority. But as we found time and time again, it's not always.
Okay, real quick, Kathleen.
Yeah, I think as we think about this problem, we need to think about it not just in the context of, you know, how many people are out on the streets and how many people are living in our homeless camps, but it also it takes a real toll on towns and cities that are supporting this. The city of Concord spends nearly a million dollars a year, whether it's providing service or, you know, emergency room visits, et cetera. That was a statistic that came out of the Concord – or a number that came out of the Concord Monitor series, and something that Mayor Jim Boulay has talked about. You know, this is – it's expensive, and we all as a community, you know, need to be talking about these issues and how we deal with them at the city level, the county level, the state level. So I think, you know, again, I just hope that people don't look at that report and say, oh, it's going down, so we're doing it right.
Because so to follow up on what Jeff said.
Exactly.
Yeah. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions and comments for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Another business story, Jeff, good thing you're here with us this week. There's a lot of business stories to catch up on. Fairpoint Communications, there's supposedly a rally going on in Concord this afternoon. The workers are still on strike. How long has this been going on?
I believe it's 10 weeks now.
It's a long time.
It's a long time now, and it's really, there's been no progress made. There was some kerfuffle, which comes pretty much weekly now with relating to Fairpoint. But apparently the governor of Vermont urged the company to, you know, sit down and negotiate, because the unions have been saying, there's three unions involved, have been saying they're not negotiating in good faith. Well, the CEO of Fairpoint, Paul Sunu, he wrote a letter to Governor Shumlin and said, no, they're the ones. The unions aren't negotiating in good faith because, you know, they're not facing reality and all this stuff. The bottom line is that these are two forces, the unions and the company, that just have seen nothing in common. You know, the company basically wants the union to give up many of its benefits and really it just kind of dial back everything that they – a lot of the things that they've gained over the years. But
no pun intended, dial back.
Given that it's a
phone company.
Very good. Usually I get those things. but the other thing is that, you know, caught in the middle of this, of course, is the customer. And they've been serious – as some people might not even know personally, there's some serious issues have been pointed out in terms of service provided by Fairpoint during this whole period.
Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Fairpoint has cited the weather as a problem, the strike as a problem. I was driving around Concord the other day, and I saw a line worker working on a telephone pole, and there were picketers, a couple guys standing by the van that said "scab" and pro union. So, I mean, clearly there's a difficult difficult situation right now. But, I had a Verizon landline for many years, and then Verizon sold to Fairpoint, and I stayed with Fairpoint. I am no longer a Fairpoint customer, and my issues were well before the weather and the union problems. So I have tremendous sympathy for the customers who are stuck in the middle of this, some of whom have been without internet and phone for over a week, for weeks. And, you know, I think fundamentally this has been – Fairpoint has had a problematic business model from the very beginning. Landlines are a dying business. Even people, you know, senior citizens who are used to having a landline, even they're switching to cell phones now. They're trying to kind of prop it up with internet service, but they've been troubled since the time they bought this business from Verizon.
Go ahead, Kathleen, and then Jeff.
Yeah, I wanted to note that I was in the State House the other day, and I was talking to a state rep in the hallway, and I can't remember where he's from, but he was getting on his laptop and trying to figure out how to get on the internet and all this stuff, and he's like, I haven't had good service for weeks because I have Fairpoint. And it's just like this level of frustration that people are feeling, and they're starting to talk about it. And, you know, you can see how visible the frustration is becoming that's not good for the company.
Yeah, when Fairpoint originally bought the landlines from Verizon several years ago, it's a small company based in North Carolina, and they bought the landlines from Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, and it made it a much, much bigger company than it ever had been. And if everybody remembers, they ended up having to declare bankruptcy and go through a whole bankruptcy reorganization to absorb what was too much of a debt that they took on. And now they're after the bankruptcy, they're having these other problems again, because one of the things is they're trying to get the cost of their labor down. And that's something that we've seen, you know, the health, the unions, they get, I think it's 100% health care. They don't have to pay anything out of pocket. And the argument from Fairpoint is, well, you know, no one else has this anymore. There's no place in America where you do that. Well, but the unions are saying, but this is stuff we've negotiated with you over years, and we'll just talk to you about it. But they're not sitting down and really trying to come to a middle ground. They're just kind of what the unions say is that Fairpoint says this is what you're going to take, and so there's no room for negotiation.
Highway, right? Yeah. All right. Well, there'll be lots to look at in the new year on this, Jeff, because
– Absolutely, because it seems like it's going to be going on for a while.
It could be going on, and if the company folds, what happens to those workers? What happens to those customers? So there'll
Absolutely.
Be more to follow up on. And coming up, we will look at a story from the city of Berlin. Police there make their case for a bearcat in the city that trees built. Also, while many Granite Staters support the local food movement, a chicken processing plant in Concord is making some nearby neighbors unhappy. We'll catch up on those stories and hear from you. So stay with us for more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you as we catch up on all the stories that happened around New Hampshire this week. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Cindy's joining us from Concord. Hi, Cindy. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the idea that I'm a nurse, and I've been a nurse for a long time, and I'm not sure how many people are aware, or the public is aware, that a lot of the homeless population, especially in the wintertime, ends up spending, you know, a lot of them will go into the hospital for treatment, and even if they're well enough to be discharged, if they happen to be at a charitable organization, such as, say, Concord Hospital, they actually sometimes will stay there for months because they don't have a place to go.
Wow.
And even if insurance isn't covering their stay, you know, because Concord Hospital is a charitable organization, they end up eating the cost. And I wonder if those numbers are included in the studies that you're talking about. I know personally that I've seen that happen every winter with several patients. And sometimes it is months.
So, Cindy, probably more people than were counted in that annual homeless count based on what you've seen just working at the hospital.
Yeah, I don't know about the numbers. I just don't know if people are aware that, you know, those people don't have a place to go, and they literally live at the hospital, even though they're well enough and they don't have to be there. The hospitals won't discharge them to an unsafe environment.
Sure. Cindy, thank you for calling in. Kathleen, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for the city of Concord specifically, you know, a question has been what – what services do we need to provide in the winter? And we've had these two churches in Concord for about a decade now that have been providing these cold weather shelters. And it was, you know, they say it was originally created as a Band-Aid, and this is the last year that they're going to be operating. So we see even with those cold weather shelters operating, we see this, what Cindy is talking about, happening. So what's going to happen, you know, if by next winter there's not another solution, what's going to happen? And I think that, you know, I know about Concord specifically, but I'm sure that these are problems that other towns and cities are dealing with as well. And so I think, you know, that's a great point for Cindy to raise and bring to our readers.
Well, Cindy, thank you very much for the call. And again, good to hear from you given your personal experience with this issue. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Another Concord caller. This is Connie calling in. Go ahead, Connie. You're on the exchange.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling about the chicken processing plant that will be coming up in the next couple of months to be built. My concern is, yes, it's a smell, and it's a shame to spend millions of dollars to fix up downtown Concord only to have a chicken processing plant. But my biggest concern is the Merrimack River. It's taken us 30-plus years to clean up a river that used to be on the top 10 most polluted rivers in the United States. And if they ever have an accident, because these two men that own the company have never built a freestanding chicken processing plant, if they have an accident, do we have anything in place to protect the river?
So, and, you know, living in Concord, Connie, I definitely appreciate the beauty and the cleanliness of the Merrimack River, and I recreate on it all the time. So thanks for calling in. You know, gentlemen, without going into the specifics of this story, I think I'll turn to you again, Jeff, because this is a business story. It's tricky. I mean, New Hampshire has this local food movement.
Yes.
People love it. People want to support it. But then, from what I understand from reporting on this, there is an issue in terms of slaughterhouses processing, yes, for local meat, which people say they want to eat. It's tough, though. I mean, there are concerns, like Connie raises, when these places are actually coming in.
It really, because the interesting thing is that there's a whole, in terms of, there's a big picture of New Hampshire. There's not enough slaughterhouses for the demand that there is for local food, as you said, and for the stuff that's being raised. Apparently, from the reports I've read, this plant in Concord would be basically working with these smaller providers. People, you know, people raise free range chickens, which is a big deal and everything, and it's kind of like, I don't want to be try glib about this, but it's kind of like the energy thing. You know, it's people want, we know we need the energy, but I don't want it here, and that's, it's at some point there's got to be some kind of a middle ground on this kind of stuff, because there is a demand for it, and whether it's in Concord or not, it needs to be somewhere. If they have that much of a demand for that kind of food, somewhere it's got to be processed.
Well, Connie, sounds like a topic to follow up on in the new year, because it's a big one. Thank you for the call. Here's an email from Robin in Hanover. I'll throw this to you, Dean Spiliotis. He says, the people of Berlin should ask themselves three questions about the Bearcat issue. This has to do with a story that we said we were going to talk about. Police in Berlin made their case this week for a Bearcat, an armored vehicle. So here's Robin's three questions that he says people in Berlin should ask. How many specific incidents of the past decade would have been handled better if Berlin had a Bearcat? Two, would you favor this purchase if the $275,000 cost were entirely borne by Berlin taxes? And three, Robin says, if it's not worth the cost for Berliners, or Berliners, I guess is how you say it, how and why to justify making the taxpayers everywhere else buy it for you? In other words, that often cities, Dean, as you know, get these armored vehicles partly through a federal government equipment sharing program. So that's Robin's reference to taxpayers elsewhere. Go ahead.
That's right. Typically these vehicles are paid for with federal grants. There are seven of these armored vehicles purchased with federal money in New Hampshire. Sometimes it's military surplus, although I believe the one in Berlin is not a military surplus vehicle. It's actually being built in Massachusetts. In the wake of Ferguson, Missouri, there's been a lot of talk about the militarization of local police forces. This is obviously going to be part of that debate in the same way the Concord Bearcat was here in Concord. The people supporting this in Berlin had said it would be useful for rescues. But also they made a reference to our northern border and the possibility of, in the past, terrorists coming across the border, and it was some sort of reference to 9/11 and some of the hijackers. It's caused a little bit of a stir trying to understand exactly what they meant by that. But they
coming
also
from
cite
Canada.
Yes, coming in from Canada. So they also cite the border as a potential for, you know, domestic and international terrorism. So there's going to be a public hearing on January 5th. But you know, it seems like cities want these. It's a $275,000 vehicle. You know, Berlin's a city of about 10,000, but they say it could be used for the region, much in the same way that the Bearcat housed in Concord is part of like a regional consortium of people paying for the upkeep.
Well, if you're in the North Country, especially the city of Berlin, and you want to chime in on this, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Robin, thanks for that email. I want to turn to a very difficult story, folks, and handle it in the best way possible. The state attorney general this week announced more than 205 additional charges against Nathaniel Kibbe, a Gorham man accused in the kidnapping case of a North Conway teenager. It was a very difficult story to read. Dean Spiliotis, I, after a while, could not get through it, so we won't go into that level of detail now. But what sort of new light does this shed on this terrible kidnapping case?
Well, I honestly think it will fundamentally change the way people think about this story. You know, this has been going on. The story has been kind of out there for a long time. And there was a lot of, you know, a lot of speculation publicly about what exactly happened. You know, was the teen kidnapped? Was this sort of a standard runaway issue? You know, sort of what happened? And the details had not really been forthcoming. It took a while for the teen to name Mr. Kibbe after returning home. But he now has been hit with, as you said, an avalanche of indictments that describe a really depraved set of behaviors. And it sort of fundamentally changes the case from no one being quite sure if this was a kidnapping or a runaway to, you know, kidnapping, I believe at gunpoint, I think I read, sexual assault, you know, holding against one's will, et cetera. Very, very difficult to read, as you said. So I think it will reshape how people think about what happened as we gear up for an eventual trial.
All right. Well, something, again, that we'll be following up on in the new year. We'll leave it at that for now. I want to go back to our listeners. And Natalie's calling from Marlboro. Hi, Natalie. You're on The Exchange, the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. I am a farmer, and I happen to be a customer of Craig's, Craig Fournier, who's trying to put that slaughterhouse in Concord there. And actually, this is not the first city he's looked at. And around not only around New Hampshire, but around New England, he was also looking at a place there in Massachusetts. And to the consumers in New Hampshire, please understand, when you go to the grocery store and you get that chicken that's pre-wrapped, that is probably not coming from anywhere in New England. There is not a single USDA facility that does birds in the state of New Hampshire, and there are just literally less than five in the entire area of New England. And as a small producer, this is such a need for us, and I can totally understand how some of the abutters and the neighbors would be concerned, but I happen to know Craig, and he's a fabulous guy, and he would never do anything you know, to be detrimental to the neighborhood in which he chooses. And if you've ever gone to a slaughterhouse, I mean, we take our animals down to Massachusetts right now, there is no scent. There is no odor coming from the slaughterhouse. And so maybe you get right up in it, right near the plant. But the houses that are up there by Adams Slaughterhouse in Athol, there's no smell at all.
So this is a
really
need,
a
Natalie, that you feel from your perspective as a chicken farmer and just for the overall state's economy.
Absolutely. I mean, if people really want to support local, then you got to support all aspects of from start to finish. And there's such a disconnect between the people, between the consumers and where their food is from. You know, they just assume that they get this nice little chicken wrapped in a store. They don't know where it comes from.
Okay.
You know, it's probably coming from thousands of miles.
Natalie, thank you very much for jumping in on this. In response to Connie, our earlier caller, who had some concerns, understandably, about the environmental impact of this plant. Thanks a lot for calling in, Natalie. And let's go to Berlin. We talked about the Bearcat debate in that city. Josh is calling in from Berlin. Go ahead, Josh. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Hello to you, guests. Yeah, I'd just like to say with the Bearcat, with the $275,000, the way revenue is raised up here, as an example, is they're changing assessing firms up here, and they had two bids. They had a New Hampshire company that bid $47,000 to assess our properties where a lot of the tax revenue base comes from. And then they had, in Haverhill, Massachusetts, they had a place that would charge us, I think it was close to $150,000 for the same assessment. Now, I don't know where they're going to pull the rabbit out of the hat for the money for this armored vehicle, but I think this is a case of basically the mouse that roared. In other words, I know that we're standing off massive armies up here that we need an armored vehicle, but I really think it's a shame that we have to militarize our police. And again, our taxpayers up here, we've lost our mill, and economically we're sorely hit. And then they run around with these toys that are very expensive, and they say the only difference between men and boys is the price of our toys.
Did you go to the meeting this week,
I wasn't able to get to the meeting, no, but it's just that I just noticed that they were going to put in a pellet mill up here. The Germans were going to back it, and the town council voted it down. And, I mean, it just seems that the goose that, that laid the golden egg, let's just say, you know, economically we're hard hit up here, and I just think the money could be much better spent than for a military-grade vehicle that, let's just say, is that we're not the enemy, Laura. We're just civilians.
All right. Josh, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. And let's go next to Barrington. Zach is on the exchange. Hi, Zach. Go ahead.
Hi there. So just one thing I didn't hear mentioned was that there is like a medium maximum security prison going up there. My grandparents up there, I'm up there twice or so a month. And the thing is, I think they're personally less worried about civilians and more about the going on at the prison.
So the federal prison in Berlin, you're saying, Zach, there could be some hardcore criminals and maybe the police need a bearcat if somebody escapes? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily hardcore criminals, but it is supposed to be a large prison from what I understand.
Yeah. So you're feeling okay about the bearcat for Berlin?
Well, I don't think they're supporting the use of that money, but they understand why there's a need for it.
Yeah. Okay. Zach, good to hear from you on that one. So Dean Spiliotis, here we go. We've got two callers, one saying, you know, kind of can see the need for it, and the other one saying, no way.
Yeah, which is usually how it goes with these kinds of issues. You know, the prison angle is an interesting angle that I hadn't heard, but, I mean, that's certainly maybe that's part of the mix. You know, the biggest question here is, you know, how you pay for these, whether it's going to be a federal grant or some federal money, but also relying on the local tax base, which I think would be more problematic for some people. I mean, we'll see what happens in January, but it is not at all uncommon now for police departments to want this type of vehicle.
Okay. So this is a very vigorous debate in Concord. Just was it last year, and it's, you know, they eventually decided that they wanted, the council voted to accept the Bearcat, but in Berlin, as one of the calls, I think it was Josh said, you know, it's. You do it does raise issues about where the money is going to come from to maintain the Bearcat, and especially in Berlin, which has been so affected, the economy up there really is in a mess. So.
Well, and Dean, you mentioned the magic word January. I can tell you that in January we will definitely be following up on all the Statehouse stuff, if I could put it that way. At the beginning of the year, we'll sit down with Statehouse leaders, talk about their agenda for the next year. Who those leaders turn out to be on the Republican side, we'll find out. We're also going to be planning some programs on energy policy, a lot of discussion around that. And we'll be looking at homelessness, given some of the issues that have been raised just recently. How about you, Kathleen Ronayne? When you look ahead to the new year, I'm going to cover this. What comes to mind?
I am going to be covering the budget. That is going to be
right.
The big
yeah.
story. And aside from the politics, things have been a little slow at the State House around the holidays. So I've been doing my best to really try and wrap my head around this big state budget that we have and all of the moving parts. And that's going to be the dominant focus of the upcoming legislative session.
And on the business beat, Jeff Feingold.
Well, I know that in terms of what's going on in the legislature, we're going to be following what's going on in terms of helping the state develop economically, economic development issues, which have been kind of backburned for many years, but kind of come into the fore. And among those is something you mentioned before, was energy, which is going to be a major, major topic in the legislature. And we'll see what happens next year.
And on the political front, Dean Spiliotis?
Well, certainly locally, the politics of this leadership fight in the Republican Party here, and also the budget's going to be fascinating as always. But I'm also waiting for Jeb Bush to show up and say hi to New Hampshire. There's a lot of speculation that him that Bush forming this leadership pack is going to somehow pressure a lot of the other candidates to throw their hat in the ring early. We'll see.
So I want some discussion of Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, yep, his aide's getting a lot of word out there that he's interested too. It's going to be a lot of fun in January.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you so much for not only being with us today, but for just helping us out all year long. I really appreciate it. Jeff Feingold, thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Kathleen Ronan, your busy lady, thank you for being here.
Always glad to be here.
Kathleen Ronan, New Hampshire State House and Politics reporter for the AP. And Dean Spiliotis, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Sure thing, Laura. Thanks.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Now, I want to remind everybody that voting is still underway on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, to help us pick the best of 2014 exchange programs. We've put up our staff's top 10 picks, but we want you to make the final cut. Then we'll play back those shows for you the last week of December. So the polls are still open. Go to nhpr.org/exchange and help us select the best exchange shows of 2014. This is The Exchange on NHPR.